I call Senate Resources Committee meeting to order. This is our 54th meeting of the session. And today is May 12th, 2026. The time is 3:30 p.m. Please turn off your cell phones. I better do that too. There we go. All right. Members present today, Senator Rauscher, Senator Kawasaki, Senator Dunbar, Senator Myers, and Vice Chair Senator Wilikowski. I'm Senator Giesel. Senator Klayman is presenting a bill in Senate Finance today. He'll be along probably later. We do have a quorum to conduct business. Today we have Mara Gwynn helping us out with keeping the records, and Chloe is helping us with the audio. We're going to hear three House bills this morning. We're going to hear House Bill 79, related to Vic Fisher Shoup Bay Marine Park. That'll be followed by House Bill 93, residency requirement, and then House Bill 117, commercial fishing. So I will invite Representative Zach Fields forward with his staff. Michael Noddy, welcome, to present House Bill 79. I do have, let's see, this is the second hearing of this bill. So, Representative Fields, if you could give us a brief recap, and then we have an amendment to be heard.
Thank you, Zach Fields, House District 17. I appreciate the committee's time and apologize for the last committee. I was buried, and I think it was gas line. So, HB 79 would name Shoup Bay Marine Park after Vic Fisher. Vic Fisher was instrumental in establishing the first set of marine parks throughout the state. A lot of people don't know that. And of course, Shoup Bay is the closest of those to Valdez. Vic Fisher planned Valdez for reconstruction after the earthquake. So just looking at the history, both of the Marine Park system and of Valdez, I thought it was a logical place to recognize his many contributions to the state.
Very good. Any questions from committee members? Seeing none, I did set an amendment deadline of 5 p.m. yesterday, and we have one amendment. Senator Dunbar?
Thank you, Mr. Madam Chair. I move Amendment A.1.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion. Senator Dunbar?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So when Vic passed away a few years ago, a number of us started thinking about things that could be named after him to recognize his achievements in the state. And I initially wanted to try and name the public policy school at UAA after him. And I brought the idea to Jane Ann Vic, his former wife, and she suggested instead that we name ICER. Vic was, in addition to being the last living signatory of the Alaska Constitution, the first director of ICER. And I've spoken with folks in UA leadership, no one has opposed it, I'll put it that way. But in the last couple of years, I haven't gotten folks to sort of move forward with the idea. And so to me, this seems like a logical place to do it. We've got a naming bill for Vic headed to the floor. And so that is why I'd like to introduce this amendment to name it the Vic Fisher Institute of Social and Economic Research. So folks could still call it ICER, or they could call it the Fisher Institute. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Any discussion? Seeing none, I will remove my objection. Is there further objection? Seeing none, Amendment number 1 has been adopted. Representative Fields, do you have any comments related to the amendment? I guess we've already adopted it, but in retrospect, have you any comments?
I think the amendment offerer was aware that I supported it, and I appreciate its coordination. There's not a better way to remember Vic's contributions, including through ICER.
All right, very good. All right, at this time, we need to open public testimony. So public testimony is now open. Is there anyone here in the room that wishes to testify on House Bill 79? Seeing none, I'm looking here online, and I see no one wishing to testify. I will close public testimony, and I will look to the will of the committee. Senator Wilikowski.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 79, Work Order 34-LS0495, /A as in Anchorage, as amended, from committee with individual recommendations and attached to zero fiscal note. Legislative legal has the authority to make necessary technical and conforming changes.
Seeing no objection, House Bill 79 is moved from committee with the attached zero fiscal note. We'll sign the transmittal documents at the conclusion of our meeting. Thank you very much,
Thank you.
Representative Fields. With that, we'll move on to House Bill 93. This is a residency requirement for hunting, trapping, and fishing. This is our second hearing of this bill. The last time the bill was before us, we heard from the sponsor staff. And looks like the staff is back again today because Representative Hemshoot is probably tied up elsewhere. So welcome, Thatcher Brower, staff to Representative Hemshoot.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the Senate Resources Committee. For the record, Thatcher Brower, staff to Representative Hemshoot. Representative Hemshoot is co-chairing the House Community and Regional Affairs Committee meeting right now and is not available but may be able to attend shortly. Madam Chair, would you like me to provide a brief recap of the bill?
Yes, please.
Yep. So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, what HB 93 does is closely aligns the requirements to get a resident hunting and fishing or trapping license with the requirements to get a permanent fund dividend. And the reason to do this is that currently the definition to get a resident license is vague and difficult to enforce. And what HB 93 would do is create a standard that is enforceable and would ensure that Alaskans who spend the majority of the year, at least 6 months of the year here, or are absent for a allowable reason, are able to enjoy the benefits of a resident license, more liberal bag limits, reduced fees, and reduced cost tags.
Very good. Thank you. And welcome, Representative Hemshoot.
Hi. Thank you. Good morning. Apologies.
No problem. We were just beginning. Committee members, any questions for Representative Hemshoot or her staff related to the bill? Yes, Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for being here to present the bill again. Had a lot of comments about this bill, but why are you using the dividend as the standard for residency as opposed to some other residency standard? And I know there's a lot of them in statute.
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, thank you very much for the question. I think it's a really important question. The dividend standard has been tested in the courts. It's stood the test of time. It's been around for quite a while. It's also adjustable, so we can add exemptions as needed going forward. And I'll just offer in most other states, this is determined by income tax. So in the absence of an income tax, we're looking to find some kind of enforceable standard that we know will work. And this is a standard that's been used repeatedly.
Cool. Any other questions? Follow-up, Senator Kawasaki?
Yeah, not a follow-up, but my question has to go to enforcement. And, you know, we've heard that it is somehow difficult to enforce the current law to figure out if a person is actually a real resident or not a real resident. Can you tell me why that's the case?
Chair Giesel, if we could go to the troopers with that question, I think they would be in the best position to answer that.
Yes. Online, Senator Kawasaki, we have Major Aaron Frenzel. Major Frenzel, welcome to the committee. If you could identify yourself for the record, and Senator Kawasaki could repeat his question or if you didn't hear it. So welcome.
Thank you, Major Frenzel. Thank you, Madam Chair. My question had to do with investigating people who are, whether they're residents or not, and whether they're prosecuting a particular fishery and how difficult that is. I just don't understand exactly why it might be difficult to prosecute a fishery and then to get violators of this residency requirement.
Thank you for the question. For the record, Aaron Frenzel, I'm the Deputy Director of Alaska Wildlife Troopers. Through the chair, Sarah Kawasaki, when we look at these cases, there's a couple things we're looking for. One is the smoking gun, and that's where an individual gains a residence benefit in another state. So if we can go down and see where they've gained a residence fishing license in Washington, maybe some kind of resident tax exemption on a place they own somewhere else. Those are the ones that are pretty easy to prosecute. It's laid out very clearly in the current regulations. The ones that are more difficult are the people that do not obtain those benefits down there, but they're living out of state for 9-10 months a year, coming up and just using Alaska's resources in July, maybe September while they're hunting. Their neighbors don't feel like they're residents. They call us, they tell us, hey, this guy is never here. So we have to look into their intent to be here, because currently there is set number of days in Alaska a resident has to be for hunting and fishing. The last thing we look at also is the 12 consecutive months prior to the purchase of the license. Has the person been here? Are they, did they come up here? Did they get their driver's license? So if we can show that they only got up here 6 months ago, was their first time stepping into Alaska, we can show that they haven't been here for 12 months. But the big one is that just timeline is when they're not really here. They might keep a house here. Is that their primary home? Is there intent to return there? Definitely. Those become very difficult for us and for the law.
Thank you. Follow up, Senator Kawasaki?
Yeah, sure. I just don't know the answer to this, but how long does it take for a person to become a resident of the state and to obtain a resident hunting or fishing license?
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, thank you for the question. Again, Major Aaron Frizzle. It is 12 months. So if a person gets here today, they are eligible on May 12th of 2027 to start gaining resident benefits in Alaska. As long as they don't gain a resident benefit in another state for the next 12 months, and they have an intent to make this their primary domicile and return here wherever they're going.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Kawasaki. Senator Rauscher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm not sure who the question goes to, but in years where I've made a lot of money, because I have a business, I never applied for PFD. So there are cargo pilots and a lot of pilots that make $300,000, maybe $200,000 a year, who probably say, well, I'm not sure I need a PFD, but I do want to hunt. What's for them? How do you prove they are able to hunt this year is my question.
And you wish to direct Representative Hemshoot?
I don't know who to ask, but if you have the answer.
Representative?
Sure. Through the chair, Senator Rauscher, we would go to the current system, which is fairly laborious. And so if someone chooses not to apply for the dividend and has a questioned residency under House Bill 93, and I want to make sure I'm correct about this so Thatcher can back me up if I'm getting it wrong, that person could still be investigated, but they would use the current system, which is having to look at plane tickets and all the documentation that they currently need to use. So it's a really drawn-out process. Whereas if someone gets the dividend, it's very straightforward. You can show your 1099 or you can show your My Alaska statement, and the troopers can actually check the dividend directly.
Mr. Brower, did you have additional comment?
Yes, Madam Chair. Again, for the record, Thatcher Brower, Staff Representative Hemshoot, and through the chair, Senator Rauscher, there's no obligation to get a permanent fund dividend to get a resident license. And as Representative Hemshoot said, they would look at whether or not you were gone for an allowable reason, whether you're here for 12 months, and if you were gone for some period of time during that 12 months, whether for an allowable reason.
Follow up, Senator Rauscher.
No, I'm good, thank you.
All right, further questions, Senator Myers.
Yeah, so Representative Hemshoot, it's my understanding that if you commit certain crimes, even after you're out of prison, you are still ineligible for the dividend. Are there any similar implications towards your hunting and fishing rights if you've been convicted of those crimes, but you stay in state, you stay a resident? And then does that have any implication for determining residency in the case of a challenge?
Thank you. Through the chair, great question, Senator Myers. And that's where the bill differs slightly from the standards of the dividend. There are a couple of things that are different. One is that does not apply for hunting and fishing, where it does to the dividend. The other place would be the 12 months. So to get the dividend, you must be here January to December. And under this bill, it is 1 year. So as Major Frenzel said, it could be May 12th of 2028 or 2027, sorry, would be when you're eligible if you arrived in Alaska today, rather than a full calendar year. So we align, but it's not exactly the same as the dividend.
Okay.
Follow up, Senator Myers.
Yeah, so just effectively the laborious process you just described to Senator Rauscher would then apply in that case if there was a challenge to somebody's residency?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions? All right, seeing none. Thank you, Representative Himshute and staff. So we I did set an amendment deadline for 5 o'clock yesterday, and we did receive an amendment. Senator Rauscher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I move amendment number one.
I'll object for purposes of discussion. Senator Rauscher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So in the previous meeting we had, I stated a lot of reasons that a person may or may not be in state because their job, they make a lot of money going in another country for a certain amount of time and home a certain amount of time as consultants. There are construction workers. There are pilots, cargo pilots. There are all kinds of people that actually leave the state to make an income. They come back. They have a house. They have a mortgage. They have cars. They have registrations for their cars. They have insurance for their cars. They buy groceries for their family. They pay for those bills for their family. They have a spouse. They have children. The children attend schools. They're making a lot of money, and they spend it here in Alaska. And if they're out of state while they're doing that, for more than 180 days, and maybe their mother gets sick, but she's not critically, according to the language in the statute, it has to be critical. And she's just sick. She broke her leg. She can't get things right away. She has to get to a doctor the first couple of weeks, whatever. You're out for 180 days, and you've got this big family here. You're paying a lot of bills. And there are other people who probably don't have a job who are not as putting that much into the economy, and they're able to hunt. But these people should not lose their hunting rights, in my opinion. And that's what this amendment does. It lists those, and it allows them to be exempt from this 180 days because they are putting into the economic value of this state. They're helping out. And I just believe that they shouldn't be excluded. That's what this bill does, that amendment does.
Discussion? Senator Wilkowski?
Yeah, thank you. I think some of these are merit some consideration. There's some huge exemptions, though, that I see. That the medical one is a tremendous broadening. I think the one that I'm most concerned about is on page 3, lines 17 through 18, on working in a trade, consulting on a matter of professional expertise, or practicing a profession not otherwise addressed. I mean, that could basically mean you just get a job out of state and you continue to say you're an Alaskan resident. So I do have some concerns just over the breadth of that. I'm curious if I could ask Madam Chair if the bill sponsor supports this amendment.
Representative Himshute.
Thank you, Chair Giesel. Through the chair, I do not support the amendment. While these are worthy of consideration, all of this should be done through the dividend. And I think we should recognize with House Bill 93, there will be additional pressure on the dividend. I know the folks at the dividend want to give a check to as many people as they can. They're not trying to withhold money from Alaskans. At the same time, it's up to us which exemptions are added. And those should be added through the dividend. And then House Bill 93 is written to adjust to changes in the dividend. That way we don't have bits of statute in different places. It all works through the dividend statute.
Thank you. Further questions, Senator Wilkowski?
Just to clarify, would the changes that we adopt now apply to the dividend as well? So in other words, if we say a person practicing a profession otherwise addressed in this subsection that would mean that we potentially have hundreds or thousands of more people eligible for the dividend?
Through the chair, I don't know if it goes both directions. I will say if the person is unable to find the work that they want to do in the state, we could consider adding that as an exemption in the dividend. But I can't speak to whether a change in 93 would change what happens in the dividend. But yes, if this were changing the dividend statute, it would be a significant change.
Mr. Brower?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thatcher Brower, staff rep, same sheet for the record. And just to clarify, I believe the way the amendment's written is it would change the dividend statute. It's updated the dividend statute.
Apologies. Thank you. Follow-up, Senator Wilkowski?
That will diminish the value of people's dividends, because I think that on page 3 alone, lines 17 through 18, will probably allow hundreds, if not thousands, of new people to be eligible for a dividend, which would diminish the value of Alaskans' dividends. So I can't support this amendment as it's written.
Senator Myers.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. On that note, let me tell you my own story on that. In 2018, I could not find a trucking job in this state to save my life because oil prices were down and there was very little activity on the slope. And I couldn't find work. We just bought a house the year before and I needed a job. So I ended up hiring on with a trucking company based outside of Chicago. Oh. And I started off driving coast to coast. And then I switched duties, and I was hauling groceries from Washington State up to Alaska. And I did that from about the middle of February of 2018 until the middle of August of 2018. And until such time as I found a job here in state, which is now my current employer. The following year, I went to go apply for my dividend. And I added up all of my days that I was gone, sat there on a calendar, kind of tried to figure it all out. I was gone for approximately 6 months. I was gone 89 days. My wife was here. My kids were here. My house was here. I was still paying a mortgage here. I was still paying my property taxes here. The whole nine yards. I was still an Alaska resident, and I was never anywhere else long enough that I could ever have considered thinking of applying for residency or being a resident anywhere else. I still had my Alaska driver's license, the whole nine yards. And as I said, I was only gone 6 months. I was working those jobs for about 6 months. If I had worked a full calendar year, I could have been pushing that 180 days pretty easily. So I know that when this bill was over in the other body that commercial pilots were brought up a lot. Truck driving is another issue. If you're stationed here in Alaska and you're hauling groceries between Washington and here, it's a 7-day round trip, roughly. So you're spending about 5 of those days outside of the state. You continue doing that week after week, month after month, you're going to hit that 180 days. And again, this is somebody who does not in any way, shape, or form look like they're moving out of state, look like they're trying to change residency any at all. So it's going to be almost impossible to try to list every profession that you could potentially be out of state for a long period of time. Transportation industry, of course, is going to be rife with it, but you're going to be able to find it in other places too. So the concerns that Senator Wilkowski is bringing up, line 17 and 18, to me, that is the fix. That is the fix that has to happen, whether we're talking about the dividend or whether we're talking about this bill with hunting and fishing rights. So this is the amendment that needs to happen in order to make this bill workable, in my mind. Thanks.
Thank you. Senator Dunbar.
Just very briefly, Madam Chair, because I think the maker of the amendment wants to speak. But I'll just say I think these are all well-intentioned, but I believe some of these are already covered. And I only say that because on section 16 on page 3, line 11, on a student exchange program, I actually did a student exchange program that was a year long, and I was able to continue to receive a dividend because of number 20 Or wherever it was, they seemed to recognize that. Granted, I was in high school, so maybe they thought it was not a big deal. But I do think that the permanent fund office, while they are certainly very diligent, I think that they are not unreasonable in a lot of cases when people are clearly intending to remain in Alaska and remain an Alaskan. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Dunbar. Further discussion about the amendment? Well, I too have some concerns about the amendment being quite broad. Serving as a missionary could actually be multiple years in length. I actually know some young people that have taught English abroad, again, years in length, significantly broadening the qualifications to receive a dividend, and certainly not necessarily meeting the intent of living here. So I have concerns about it as well. Welcome, Senator Klayman. Further questions or discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, do you have closing remarks, Senator Rocher?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, there was, I think, kind of an oversight. I didn't realize it was pertaining to the PFD. It was supposed to be for hunting license only. That's what the intention was, so we wouldn't be changing the definition of the PFD. I'm probably going to withdraw because my intention was for a hunting license. Okay, so I think that it'd be a heavy lift to try and move it for the PFD. I just don't see that happening, and I'm going to recant. I'll just let it vote because a lot of people are hoping that this will get voted on and I can vote yes and people can vote no. Thank you.
Yeah. All right. Further discussion on the amendment. I am not going to remove my, maintain my objection. So, Merigwin, would you please call the roll? We are voting now on the adoption of amendment number G1.
No.
Senator Kawasaki?
No.
Senator Rauscher?
Yes.
Senator Dunbar?
No.
Senator Klayman?
No.
Senator Myers?
Yes.
Senator Giesel?
No.
Five nays.
And so on a vote of 2 yeas and 5 nays, amendment number G1 has failed to be adopted. This takes us back to the original bill. I have no further amendments. So we are now going to open public testimony on the bill. Thank you very much, Representative Himshut and staff. We're going to open public testimony on the bill. I will start here in the room. I see Steve. Opening public testimony, I see Steve Bradford in the room wishing to testify. Mr. Bradford, please come forward. After he speaks, we will go online. I see David Eggleston in Thorn Bay. So let me just set some guidelines here. Mr. Bradford and those of you online who wish to testify, I'm allowing 2 minutes. You will be asked to identify yourself by name and any affiliation with any particular groups that you might have. And it will be a 2-minute limit. We do have quite a few people lined up. So when your 2 minutes is up, I will tell you your 2 minutes is up, and the audio, our LIO moderator will cut off the call so we can move on so everyone can be heard. So welcome, Mr. Bradford. I'll let you begin.
Thank you. Yes, my name is Steve Bradford. I'm a 51-year Alaska resident. I'm residing here in Juneau, Alaska, and I'm representing myself. Today, I would like to offer this testimony on HB 93. I believe this legislation violates state and federal laws. My first point is that Article 8, Section 3 of the Alaska Constitution states, quote, whenever occurring in their natural state, fish, wildlife, and waters are reserved to the people for common use, unquote. My second point, Article 8, Section 17 of the Alaska Constitution states, quote, laws and regulations governing the use or disposal of natural resources shall apply equally to all persons similarly situated, unquote. This means all residents shall have equal laws and regulations applied equally for fish and game purposes, not just residents that meet criteria for PFD eligible or residents are gone for 180 days or more. Point number three, Alaska's common use doctrine is a key principle legal principle that clearly states, and the courts have upheld, that fish and wildlife belong to all Alaskans collectively. Point four, residency is defined in Alaska Statute 01.10.055. In particular, I quote subparagraph C, quote, a person who establishes residency in the state remains a resident during an absence from the state unless during the absence the person establishes or claims residency in another state, territory, or country, or is absent under circumstances that are inconsistent with the intent required under A of this section to remain a resident of the state, unquote. Is that my 2 minutes?
That's your 2 minutes.
Wow, okay.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Yeah, thanks.
All right.
So he can submit it in writing.
He has submitted in writing. Yes, I believe it is in your packet of materials, but the secretary is right there, and she can take your written testimony as well. And for the folks online, you can send in your testimony. There was a packet of testimony sent out, and I actually read it, and I believe those statements were in the testimony. But you're welcome to also leave it with our secretary.
I will. Thank you for this opportunity.
Oh, of course. Thank you for coming. Next up, we're hearing from David Eggleston in Thorn Bay. After Mr. Eggleston will be Cabot Pitts in Palmer. Mr. Eggleston, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is David Eggleston. My wife and I are residents of Southeast Alaska. I'm chairman of the East Prince of Wales Advisory Committee, the secretary of the Thorn Bay Fisheries Association, and a member of Southeast Alaska Guides Organization. I strongly support HB 93. It will help tighten up the loopholes that are allowing thousands of people from improperly claiming residency in Alaska. It will give our Alaska troopers better tools to enforce our residency laws. In past testimony to legislative committees, I repeated much of what others have said, trying to explain why this bill needs to be passed. When I listened to questions from the committees, it struck me that many of the legislators do not hunt or fish and therefore couldn't fully understand the importance of this bill. The short story is that residents are generally allowed to take more fish and game than non-residents. Rural residents are able to take certain fish and the wildlife for subsistence use. This is very important for those off the major road systems. What we see throughout the state are people coming to Alaska year after year claiming to be residents. They purchase resident sporting license instead of the more expensive non-resident licenses. They take extra resources as residents or subsistence users. We see many boxes and sometimes freezers full of fish and game heading south on the ferries every year with fake residents. The state needs a better way to stop this misappropriation of resources. Not only will this bill save fish and game, but it will also push people to purchase the more expensive non-resident sporting licenses to help ADF&G financially. I urge you to move this bill out of committee, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Next up is Cabot Pitts calling in from Palmer. He'll be followed by Brett Bradford in Cordova. Mr. Pitts, welcome.
Hi, yes, thank you. Hopefully everybody can hear me. I'm calling remote from, I'm actually down in Naknek, Alaska right now. But for the record, my name is Cabot Pitts. I'm a resident of Palmer, Alaska, and I'm representing myself in this testimony. I'm a hunting outfitter and an air taxi operator here in the state, and I just appreciate you for allowing me to speak this morning. And I would just like to start by saying our wildlife resources are very valuable in our state and are very dear to me as well, as I make most of my living from non-resident hunters and hunters in the state wanting to access our wildlife resources. So I am in support of House Bill 93 aligning this residency requirement for residents and non-residents in the state. I can attest and speak very deeply about this issue, and being an Alaskan resident is a huge investment that one takes to actually living in the state full time to benefit from these privileges we are allowed as Alaska residents. It's important for residents of Alaska to truly live in and contribute to the state in order to fully benefit from these resources that we have. The liberal, you know, bag limits and allowances for residents benefits everybody, especially people living in remote villages and just being in the state alone. So our Alaska resources and opportunities, including more liberal subsistence fishing and hunting rights, are reserved for those people who actively live here. So there's a need for a clear, enforceable standard, I believe, on residency. And without that standard, it's a huge burden on our law enforcement, and a burden of this enforcement keeps, you know, all of our law enforcement officials in the field to be able to make those calls and things that they need to do while they're out there. So by simply holding an address here isn't enough. I generally think the residency means supporting local businesses, engaging in the community, and investing in our future in the state. And these benefits are designed to support those who call Alaska home, not just on paper, but in practice.
Thank you very much, Mr. Pitts, for your testimony. Next is Brett Bradford. He will be followed by Mark Richards in Fairbanks. Mr. Bradford, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning. Brett Bradford, Cordova, Alaska, 51-year resident of the state. I'm the chairman of the board of the Copper River Prince William Sound Marketing Association. I'm on the board of directors for Prince William Sound Aquaculture Corporation. I'm also a member of the Regional Advisory Committee here in Cordova. HB 93 puts an unreasonable burden on residents who spend time outside of the state but still maintain residency in Alaska. One group of people affected by these are retirees who have spent most of their life, if not all of their lives, working, raising families in Alaska, and enjoy time outside in the wintertime. Now that they're retired, the sponsors of this bill aim to penalize these residents. Another group affected negatively are resident commercial fishermen who must, for economic reasons, continue to fish outside of the state during winter months in order to continue to make a living. In the sponsor statement version G, updated March 25th, the sponsors claim that current residency requirements are a, quote, loophole in regards to Alaska residents who hunt and fish. In the next paragraph, and I quote, it says, they use the word importantly, this bill does not change the bag and possession limits for out-of-state hunters or fishermen who come to Alaska. And moving down, it says, in addition, the important guided hunting and fishing industries will not be impacted by this bill. It seems that the sponsors of this bill are prioritizing access of our fish and game resources to non-residents and the guided hunting and fishing industry over our lifelong residents. If we're concerned with resource availability, let's put restrictions on the charter operators and the guides and the non-resident users. Please stop this bill from moving forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Next up is Mark Richards calling in from Fairbanks. He will be followed by Mark Keller, who is calling in from Minnesota. Mr. Richards, welcome.
Good morning, Chair Giesel, Vice Chair Wilkowski, and members of the Resources Committee. For the record, my name is Mark Richards, and I'm calling in today for resident hunters of Alaska, the Marine Conservation Organization that advocates for sustainable wildlife management policies with an emphasis on protecting and enhancing resident opportunities. Resident hunters of Alaska opposes HB 93 as written. You should have the letter we sent in. We certainly don't want non-residents to be able to hunt and fish up here under a resident license and bag limits. And we want to again sincerely thank Representative Hemshute for introducing this bill and trying to fix what is a real problem, especially in Southeast Alaska with fishing. But as we say in our letter, this is a big catch-22 for us, because the way this bill would define who is a resident in terms of a hunting or fishing license, it's going to negatively affect real Alaskans who don't fall under the PFD exemptions. We had originally asked for amendments to exempt certain individuals who may work out of state more than 180 days and don't meet the PFD eligibility requirements, but they really do live here, have a spouse and children here, et cetera. Those amendments did not pass, but now we see some separate legislation that would modify the PFD eligibility requirements to get those exemptions. We preferred to figure out first what workers should get an exemption and include those exemptions within this bill. Again, Madam Chair and members of the committee, while we certainly support the intent of this legislation, we just can't support it as written due to the number of real Alaskans who will be disenfranchised from holding a resident hunting or fishing license. There must be a better way of defining who is and isn't a resident in order to fix this problem. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Next up is Mark Keller calling in from Rochester, Minnesota. He'll be followed by Gary Hollier. Mr. Keller, welcome.
Yes, thank you. Hey, my name is Mark Keller, and I represent myself, and I'm a resident of Anchorage, and I oppose HB 93 just because I feel it's too restrictive. I'm actually currently in Rochester, Minnesota, and I'm helping my dad with some pretty complicated medical issues that he's had over the last several years. So I did submit some testimony, and I'll read a little bit from it, but it says, it's reported that these changes would likely mirror the current requirements for the permanent dividend fund. If this bill becomes law, it will take away my rights as a resident. Let me explain. Currently, I must provide care for my aging parents who live in Minnesota. I am a durable power of attorney for my father, and I must care for him as needed. It is not possible for my father to move to Alaska. His condition will not allow it, and Alaska does not offer interdisciplinary specialty and expert medical care that he requires. As a result, I may on time to time be absent from Alaska more than the proposed HB 93 requirement of 180 days. I believe that the current version of HB 93 should either be rejected or revised. I would at the very least recommend that Alaska allow meritorious exemptions process for residents with special circumstances. This exemption should allow residents with special circumstances to be exempt from the 180-day requirement that's set forth in HB 93. This exemption already exists for members of the military, individuals serving on a staff of United States Congress, and employees that of the state that are in office in another location. And also, another.
Thank you, Mr. Keller, for your testimony. Next up is Gary Hollier calling in from Kenai. He'll be followed by Al Barrett. Mr. Hollier, welcome.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Gary Hollier. I'm a 72-year-old lifelong resident of Alaska. I have a small business and two corporations in Alaska. I've qualified for every PFD. I'm deeply concerned and opposed to HB 93. This bill fairly targets older Alaskans like me who spent a lifetime built in Alaska, paying taxes, voting, raising families, contributing to our communities. Many seniors spend longer periods outside for medical care, to visit families, or simply to escape harsh winter conditions. This does not mean Alaska is no longer my home. I am an Alaskan. The PFD already has strict residency requirements. They examine whether a person maintains Alaska as their true and permanent home through a driver's license, voter registration, property ownership, vehicle registration, and many other factors. Residency is already carefully defined. A simple day count does not tell the full story of someone's real home, where it is. HB 93 would create a second class of Alaskans, particularly retirees and seniors, by punishing people for their age and lifestyle, despite maintaining every legal tie to Alaska. Younger working Alaskans may be able to stay year-round because of employment, while retirees have more flexibility. This flexibility should not cost them rights they've earned through decades of residency. Alaska has always valued independence and individual circumstances. This bill ignores those values and replaces them with an arbitrary number. A lifelong resident should not lose resident privilege just because they spend more time caring for their health, their grandchildren, or their quality of life outside of Alaska during part of the year. I urge you to oppose HB 93 and protect the rights of Alaska, including seniors and who proudly call Alaska home. I ask you, if I get zero benefits from another state, where should I be able to hunt and fish if I get zero benefits from another state? If you were a senior citizen, I ask these senators and or if their parents were, should they be cut off from the rights that they have actually had?
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Hollier. Next up is Mr. Alberette. He'll be followed by Rod Arno. Mr. Barrett, welcome.
Good day, Senator Giesel and Vice Chair Wielkowski and members of the Senate Resources. My name is Alberette. I reside in Fairbanks. I am commenting on HB 93. I'm also currently a member of the Board of Game. I'm not representing the Board of Game or any positions the Board of Game has taken on HB 93. I'm only representing my thoughts and opinions as an old resident Alaskan. I only fundamentally oppose HB 93 because it really is not addressing the problems that are inherent with enforcement of it. I believe that the amendments to the language found in 1605.330 to 1605.430, where it says a physical presence in a state with the intent to remain in the state indefinitely. And I think if you further pursue that with Major Frenzel, that's one of their highest hurdles they have to prove is somebody's intent to remain in the state indefinitely. I would have you ever heard an Alaskan colleague, friend, or peer, or coworker, or somebody that may have said to yourself, when I retire, I'm moving outside to be closer to my grandchildren and children because of that reason. So when a person, Alaskan resident, makes that statement, their intent changes, do you believe they're not complying with the law currently when they make a statement like that? I believe that if you rescind the language, remove the leave with the intent to remain in the state indefinitely, and redefine domicile to what you want it to say or not want it to say, that this would be a bigger tool for wildlife enforcement to enforce the residency laws. And the other issue is tying this to the dividend and saying that the troopers can go check to see if somebody received a permanent fund. I mean, it's not even a rumor anymore. The application and the...
Thank you, Mr. Barrett, for your testimony. Next up is Rod Arno. He'll be followed by Ken Voracek. Mr. Arno, welcome.
Yes, thank you, Chairman and committee members. My name is Rod Arno, Palmer, Alaska, and I represent the Alaska Outdoor Council and the Alaska Outdoor Council opposes the passage of HB 93. It's the wrong direction. In the legislation, there isn't anything in the bill that would add tools to the troopers' ability to follow through with citations on determination of residency. And AS 1605.415, determination of residency, right in the Fish and Game Code, it says, you know, that the person is physically present in the state with the intent to remain in the state indefinitely and make their home in the state. It's right there. So there's problems with the enforcement, I think. Looking back at what I'm reading to you, 1605.415, you know, every tool that the Outdoor Council's looked at is there for enforcement. But if there's something that the city would like to add to that, let them know that instead of tying it to the 180 days, because there's 100,000 Alaskans who don't fill out a PFC and get it. So, whether they're commercial fishermen, I know a bunch of them that get out, whether they're retirees, I'm real close to that, or whether they're federally qualified subsistence hunters, because according to the CFR's 106 license. In order for a rural resident to hunt on federal land with federal regulations, he has to have an Alaska resident hunting license. So the folks are going to be disqualified then.
Thank you, Mr. Arno, for your testimony. Next up is Ken Voracek calling in from Fairbanks, and he will be followed by Jill Weitz here in the room. Mr. Voracek, welcome.
Thank you. Ken Voracek, live in Fairbanks. I'm testifying on behalf of myself. In 1972, I was 21 years old, left Ohio with $500 and a Datsun pickup truck. For the next 54 years, I made Fairbanks my home. I raised a family here, had numerous businesses, contributed to Alaska's growth, and I continue to be a productive resident. Now at 75 years old, Alaska wants to take away my very lifestyle that I've earned and love. Wildlife Trooper Frenzel testified that they investigated about 118 residency violations in the past year or so, yet HB 93 will strip about 100,000 legal Alaskan residents of their current fishing game privileges. HB 93 fully supports having over 500,000, that's half a million, non-residents hauling fish out of the state each year, but apparently my wife and I are the problem. Make no mistake, my soul lives 365 days in Alaska, and my residency is still a net benefit to this state. I challenge anyone to give me one good reason how the current fish, how my current fishing game access is harming the state or its wildlife, or how HB 93 is going to fix anything of consequences. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And now we have Jill Weitz here in the room in Juneau. Ms. Weitz, welcome.
Good morning, Chair Giesel and members of the Senate Resources Committee. For the record, my name is Jill Weitz. I live in Juneau and serve as government affairs for the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska. Tlingit and Haida is the regional tribe of Southeast, and we represent over 38,000 tribal citizens. Tlingit and Haida is also a member of the Alaska Regional Coalition, representing 165 communities and approximately 99,000 Alaskans throughout or through seven regional tribal nonprofit organizations. Together, we provide lawmakers with on-the-ground insight into the realities facing rural communities and tribal citizens. On behalf of Tlingit and Haida and ARC, I am here in support of House Bill 93. For Native Alaska communities and many rural Alaskans, subsistence is not a recreational activity. It is a cornerstone of food security, cultural continuity, and community well-being. Salmon, halibut, deer, moose, and other traditional foods are central to how families feed themselves and sustain their way of life. House Bill 93 helps ensure that resident hunting and fishing privileges are aligned with Alaska's established residency standards. By aligning with the permanent fund dividend framework, it creates a clear, more consistent, and more enforceable system. This bill addresses several key issues. It helps reduce misuse of residence license by individuals who do not live in Alaska year-round, but still benefit from lower fees and higher harvest limits, placing additional pressure on already strained resources. It also helps protect subsistence access, which for many communities can mean the difference between having enough food for the winter or not. Ensuring that resident privileges are applied consistently is a practical step that the state can make to reduce pressures. House Bill 93 is about protecting the resources Alaska communities depend on every day. We appreciate the legislature's attention to this issue and respectfully urge your support. Thank you for your service and the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much, Ms. Weitz. With that, that concludes the people that have signed up to testify. I will close public testimony. Mr. Thatcher, I see Representative Wayne Hemshoot has had to depart. So I will invite you forward for any closing remarks related to the bill. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Giesel. Again, for the record, Thatcher Brower, Staff Director at Hemshoot. I don't have any prepared closing comments, but I'm more than happy to answer questions.
Are there any questions? Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I was sort of moved by the testimony of the gentleman who is living out of state and taking care of his father. But I looked at the language provided by Senator Rauscher in the amendment, and I feel like it would be covered by one of these exceptions. I mean, there are exceptions in the existing PFD statute. One, page 2, line 19, receiving continuous medical treatment. Line 22, providing care for a parent, spouse, sibling, child, etc. Line 27, providing care for the individual's terminally ill family member. I mean, are those exceptions for a variety of medical care incorporated either by reference or explicitly in your bill, and how would you see that operating?
Yes. Again, for the record, Thatcher Brower, Senator Pazin-Himshut, and through the chair, Senator Dunbar, you are correct. There are a number of allowable absences for medical issues, and I don't know the particulars of this case and whether or not it would qualify, but under our bill, all the allowable absences for medical care or for caring for somebody who's undergoing treatment would apply.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Very good. Senator Kawasaki, question.
Thank you. So I'm trying to think of circumstances. So if a person were to decide to get off that boat today and stay in Juneau for 1 year, they would qualify as a resident for purposes of hunting and fishing after that 12-month period. Is that correct?
Thatcher Brower, Staff Rep. Himshut, for the record, and through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, that is correct.
And then if they were to fly back home to wherever they're from, but say that they maintained residency here in Alaska and then come back, they would immediately be a resident for purposes of hunting and fishing when they were to come back, if they were to have said that they were going to be a resident of Alaska.
Thatcher Brower, for the record, and through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, or just to clarify your question, are you talking about under existing law or with HB 93?
Under the existing law.
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, that is my understanding, and I'd be happy to defer to Major Aaron Frenzel, too. He may have a clearer answer.
Major Frenzel, again, a question for you. Did you hear Senator Kawasaki's question, and can you respond?
Thank you, Chair Diesel. I caught it, but if he can repeat it, I'd appreciate it just to get a clear answer.
Senator Kawasaki.
Basically, I'm trying to clarify. So if I were to get a resident hunting and fishing license in the state and then leave Alaska tomorrow and then be gone for a long time, but then decide to come back, still having my household in Fairbanks, Alaska, would I still be able to qualify for that resident hunting and license because I never and using like my home in Fairbanks as a permanent address?
Yes, through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, for the record, Aaron Frenzel, Wildlife Troopers. Yes, you would, as long as you do not obtain another benefit in another state. Your primary domicile remains in Alaska, and that intent to remain here is there. There's no set number of days you can be that makes you a non-resident if you're gone for.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you. Just to be clear, if you're a resident of Alaska and you have no other exemptions, how long can you be gone from the state and still be considered a resident under this proposal?
Is this question for Major Frenzel?
This is for
Mr. Brower.
Mr. Brower?
Thatcher Brower, for the record, and through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, with this bill, you would be able to be gone for 180 days or absent for a longer period of time if it was for allowable reason.
Follow up, so, Senator Wilkowski.
So for retirees or snowbirds, they can be gone for 6 months and still be considered an Alaska resident. Is that right?
Thatcher Brower, for the record, and through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, that is correct.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Very good. I see no further questions. Thank you, Mr. Brower. Thank you, Major Frenzel. I'm looking to the will of the committee. Senator Wilkowski.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 93, Work Order 34-LS0058/G as in Golovin from committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note. Legislative legal has the authority to make necessary technical and conforming changes.
Objects.
There's an objection. Would you like to speak to your objection?
Yeah, I just wanted to add something here. Representative Himshut included a paper here, basically the costs of what it would be to go from a non-resident or from a resident to a non-resident status for hunting. Bison tag, you would pay nothing as a resident, but you would pay $900 as a non-resident. $25 for a grizzly bear tag, $1,000 as a non-resident, but you also have to hire a guide, which goes into the tens of thousands. Muskox cow tag, $25 for a resident and $2,200 for a non-resident. Now, there was about four or five gentlemen stated that there were 100,000 PFDs that weren't applied for. This seems like a moneymaker for the state. That's what I see out of it, but that's just a statement. And I see that it's hard to argue that it wouldn't be, but I just wanted to make that statement.
Thank you, Senator Rosher. I will follow up that statement. About 8 years ago, the representative from the area you are the senator for brought forward these hunting and fishing fees. These are still well under what other states charge for their prize hunting tags. But we did raise the fees, it is true, about 8 years ago.
Follow up,
Senator Rauscher.
I wasn't complaining about the fee itself. I was explaining the difference that you are not a resident now and the amount you would be paying if you are a non-resident. As opposed to a resident. That's all. I wasn't complaining about the fees. I just want you to know. Okay, thank you.
Thank you for that clarification. Senator Kawasaki.
Yeah, and thanks. And I see it in a different way. I think what this says is that clearly there's a benefit to being a resident of the state of Alaska. And that resident and us as residents who live here year-round should be able to benefit more than a person who's a part-time resident or not resident, not what I would consider a resident of the state.
Thank you. There has been objection to adoption of the motion to move the bill. Is the objection sustained?
Yes.
Mayor Gwynn, would you please call the roll? The motion has been to move House Bill 93 from committee with individual recommendations and attach zero fiscal note. Mayor Gwynn?
Senator Dunbar.
Yes.
Senator Klayman.
Yes.
Senator Wilikowski.
Yes.
Senator Kawasaki.
Yes.
Senator Myers.
No.
Senator Rauscher.
No.
Senator Giesel.
Yes.
5 yeas, 2 nays.
And so by a vote of 5 yeas and 2 nays. House Bill 93 moves from committee with attached zero fiscal notes and individual recommendations. We will sign the transmittal documents at adjournment. Next up, we have House Bill 117, Commercial Fishing, Set Gillnet Cooperative. The last up on our, this bill was before the committee in the past, and we have an updated committee substitute to consider. Senator Wilikowski.
Madam Chair, I move to rescind the previous action of passing from committee House Bill 117, Work Order 34-LS0557, /I as in Igiagig, as amended.
Seeing no objection, the action of passing version I of House Bill 117, as amended, is rescinded. Members, before you is a draft committee substitute for this bill. Senator Wilikowski.
I move the committee adopt the committee substitute for House Bill 117, Work Draft 34-LS0557, /T as in Trapper Creek, as our working document.
And I will object for purpose of the discussion, and I will invite Representative Stutz and her staff, Matt Greening, forward to explain the changes made in the committee substitute. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Matt Greening, staff to Representative Louise Stutz. The CS version T before you contains several notable changes from the version that passed from committee. First, and unfortunately, the original SetNet language in House Bill 117 regarding SetNet cooperative deliveries and commingling of fish was removed. Senate Bill 158 in its entirety, which is in the other body right now, has been added. As members of this committee may recall, Senate Bill 158 creates a new SetNet administrative area in the east side of Cook Inlet. That language can be found on sections 1, 4, 6, and 7 of the new committee substitute. Additionally, there was a slight change to the electronic monitoring language as it compares to the language that left the committee before, and that's on page 4, line 16 of the new CS. The word finfish was inserted in front of trawl fishery to clarify that the electronic monitoring requirement does not apply to shrimp or scallop fisheries. Those are smaller boat fisheries, and they don't have a parallel electronic monitoring requirement on a federal level.
Very good. Representative Stutz, do you have comment about this committee substitute?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Louise Stutz representing Cordova, Kodiak, Seward, and several smaller coastal communities. I'm very supportive of the committee substitute, but I'm obviously a little disappointed that our original language was removed from the bill. I want to say for the record that addressing cooperative set net deliveries and commingling fish is a good policy that simply preserves the cooperative family model for set netting that has existed since statehood. From the bottom of my heart, truly, I would like to thank every stakeholder who engaged and supported House Bill 117. However, there was some concern from stakeholders in one particular region, and it became apparent during the last hearing. Try as we might, and we did, we were unable to resolve those concerns with the short time that we have left in session. I intend to work with the stakeholders over the interim to come up with a workable solution to remove any concerns and bring the bill forward once again. Recognizing the political reality of where we are in our original bill needing additional work over the interim, I'm supportive of moving forward with the electronic monitoring language as well as Senate Bill 158, the new administrative area in Cook Inlet. I think it will be good for our industry. And I think it's appropriate that we move forward. Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity.
Thank you, Representative Stutz. I'm distracted by the outside noises, but I'll get past it. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Stutz, for bringing this. I support the elements that are currently in the bill. I like what's in the bill. But I also really like what you had before. I mean, growing up in Prince William Sound, I've heard from a number of folks and from your region, obviously, that were concerned about the new administrative interpretation of the rules that families have used for generations. So can you give me a little bit more about why it was removed? What region and what were their concerns?
Thank you, Senator Dunbar, through the chair. Representative Louise Stutz. It was basically the Bristol Bay area, and they had some questions. They have a different type of, they have over 900 permits there, and they felt like they needed a little more information and a little more time to disseminate to exactly how this was going to work. We have had the good fortune of working with our Department of Public Safety, the CFPC, and the Department of Fish and Game in addressing their concerns. But it's just so close to the end of session that we will be bringing that bill back next year, and we feel like over the interim we have a workable solution with everybody involved.
Thank you
for the question.
Thank you, and thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Any further questions for Representative Stutz? Thank you, Representative Stutz. I am going to ask Senator Bjorkman to come forward. The piece that is in the proposed committee substitute is a piece from a provision that he had brought forward. I will offer him an opportunity to make comment on the committee substitute. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Chair Giesel and members of the esteemed Senate Resources Committee. For the record, my name is Senator Jesse Bjorkman, and I represent the northern and central portions of the Kenai Peninsula. As you heard, my bill previously and passed it out. That is now included in this bill. I'm strongly supportive of the new administrative area in Cook Inlet as it allows for self-determination of east side Setneters and their ability to uniquely manage their permits through CFEC in a matching way as they are uniquely managed through an allocation perspective by the Board of Fish.
Very good. Are there questions for Senator Bjorkman? Seeing none, thank you for bringing for commenting on the committee substitute. Seeing no objection, I'm going to remove my objection to adopting the committee substitute for House Bill 117, version T, as our working document. Is there further discussion about version T from committee members? Seeing none, Senator Wilkowski.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 117, Work Order 34-LS0557/T as in Thorn Bay from committee as amended with forthcoming new fiscal notes and individual recommendations. Legislative legal has the authority to make any necessary and conforming changes.
Seeing no objection, House Bill 117, Version T moves from committee with additional forthcoming fiscal notes and individual recommendations. This concludes the 54th meeting of the Senate Resources Committee for this session. Our next meeting will be this afternoon at 3:30, meeting number 55. At that time, we will be hearing additional information about Senate Bill 280, the Supporting a Gas Line for Alaskans Act. The Department of Revenue will be speaking to us, and if time, we will get to amendments. At this time, we will adjourn. Please remain and sign the transmittal documents. The time is 10:11 a.m.
Hi, this is Zach from the LAO calling for soundcheck.
Hey, Zach, this is Mike 1.
Sounds good.
Mike 2?
2's good.
Mike 3?
3's good.
Chair Mike?
Chair Mike sounds good.
Mike 4?
Mike 4 is good.
Mike 5?
5's good.
Mike 6?
Mike 6 sounds good.
Testifier 1?
Testifier 1 sounds good.
And Testifier 2?
Testifier 2's good.
Senate Records?
Senate Records sounds good.
All right, and how's that on Teams?
Sounds great on Teams.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Yeah, have a good meeting, Chloe.
I call Senate Resources Committee meeting to order. Today is Tuesday, May 12th, 2026, and the time is 3:30 p.m. Please turn off your cell phones. Members present today on the phone is Senator Rauscher. Senator Myers is here, Senator Dunbar, myself, Senator Giesel. Senator Klayman will be a little late today, and Senator Kawasaki and Vice Chair Wilikowski are in Senate State Affairs right now. They will be along shortly. Welcome and thank you to Juliana and Chloe for helping us out with the audio and so forth. Today we're having our 55th meeting, and the subject today is the Supporting the Gas Pipeline for Alaskans Act. And we are continuing a discussion related to the project modeling by the Department of Revenue. So I will invite Dan Stickle forward. He is our chief economist with the tax division. And Mr. Stickle, you were going to be continuing a presentation you started a few days ago. I can't remember if it was yesterday. I don't think it was yesterday.
Yesterday.
Was it yesterday?
Yesterday afternoon.
With two meetings a day, it's hard to... Anyway, the presentation for people at home is titled Senate Bill 280, Senate Resources CS Version H, and it's dated May 11th, 2026. I think we were at slide 28. Is that about right? Detailed project modeling. So welcome, Mr. Stickle.
All right, thank you. For the record, Dan Stickle, Chief Economist with Department of Revenue. So to recap, yesterday we walked through the proposed legislation for version H, as well as our understanding of what the bill would do, and our fiscal note and our implementation costs, and then the remaining slides were our detailed project modeling slides. So we'll start with slide 24, which recaps our key assumptions, and I think this is where we had left off yesterday. But to recap, we're modeling 32 years of gas sales, which includes 30 years of full exports, $46.2 billion assumed construction cost for the pipeline, $1.50 per 1,000 cubic feet gas purchase price on the North Slope, and then two phases of production, phase one coming from a to-be-determined field that does require treatment costs, and then phase two in the anchoring of the project being from Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson Fields.
Any questions on this slide? Okay.
So slide 25 just highlights the three scenarios we're running. So we're looking at the current law scenario, which would be if the AKLNG project proceeded under our current property tax regime with no tax relief provided, Senate Bill 280 as introduced by the governor, and then the version H committee substitute. And so for each of these, we're showing the impact if the project proceeded, which is not a certainty under each of the under some of the scenarios.
All right.
Slide 26 is a slide I've shown before. This is our summary analysis for the current tax law. And again, to highlight those cost of supply numbers is what we really zero in on when comparing this this slide to the other slides. So under current tax law without property tax relief, the in-state break-even cost of supply would be $4.86 in per 1,000 cubic feet in 2033, and the delivered LNG price into the global market would be $9.07. And that represents the price that the developer would need to receive for the gas in order to achieve a 10% rate of return on the project, given all of our other assumptions. The numbers on the top part of this slide are the cash flow summaries. So for the state, federal, and municipal, this represents total revenue to each of those for the upstream and the midstream. This represents It is their total revenue, but these are not profits. These are just the cash flows that come in. And so all of any costs have to be paid out of these numbers.
Good. I see no questions.
Slide 27 is the similar chart with Senate Bill 280 as introduced by the governor. And so we can see for the in-state cost of supply, the bill as introduced by the governor would have decreased that in-state break-even from $4.86 down to $4.43 per 1,000 cubic feet, and the break-even LNG price into the global market from $9.07 down to $8.48 per 1,000 cubic feet.
I see no questions.
And then slide 28 is the similar slide for the committee substitute before the committee. Based on all of the provisions, the in-state break-even cost of supply would be $4.81, so about 5 cents below current law. And the global market break-even would be $9.11, which would be 4 cents per 1,000 cubic feet higher than under the current law scenario. And so one of the reasons you may ask, why is the cost of supply a little bit lower under the in-state and a little bit higher under the export? So one of the provisions of this bill is that there are caps on the in-state sales price to utilities. Mm-hmm. It's the $12 per 1,000 cubic feet before exports begin, and then $5 per 1,000 cubic feet after exports begin. And effectively what that does is we model that as a cost to the project. So those costs have to be absorbed at some point. And so when you get later into the time horizon and the cost of supply would increase with inflation, that difference between whatever the sales price would be and the $5 cap, we assume that has to be recouped through the LNG sales.
Okay, see no questions.
Slide 29 is our chart of annual state revenues. This is under the current law scenario. Again, early on, we have a few years of slight reductions to state revenues as we assume that upstream producers will be making investments to expand production at Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson to be able to deliver gas into the project. And then once full exports begin, looking at about $1 billion per year of total state revenues. And this would be under current law if the project were to proceed with no tax changes.
No questions.
Slide 30, under the bill is introduced, we have a similar story in the early years, and then about $800 million per year of state revenues. And that $200 million per year represents the tax reduction in the governor's version of the bill.
I see no questions.
Slide 31 is a similar chart for the committee substitute. And so we see there is still some temporary reductions in revenue in the early years as upstream producers make those investments. Once full exports begin, we're looking at about $1 billion per year of state revenue. And then in the later years, that revenue number actually increases quite significantly to up over $1.6 billion in the 2050s. And so what's going on there is this bill adds escalators to the alternative volumetric tax based on 2.5% inflation, we're assuming, rather than a 1% escalator in the bill as proposed. And those escalators are coming on a higher base rate. This bill also extends corporate income tax to non-C corporations, and that becomes a significant contributor to revenue in the later years.
Senator Myers.
Thank you. Mr. Stickle, does this chart include the community impact fee
that's in the bill?
Senator Myers, through the chair, yes, it does. So we're modeling that as a pass-through revenue to the communities, though, so it wouldn't be included in this chart. The analysis does include the community impact fee.
Okay, thank you.
Very good. I don't see any other questions.
So slide 32 is our sensitivity matrices, similar to what we've shown before. Shows that in-state gas break-even price in 2033 based on a range of upstream gas purchase prices to the producers, and then a range of capital costs starting with our $46.2 billion assumed project cost and ranging sensitivities up to 100% capital cost increase. And then you can see the $1.50 and the base CapEx has the $4.86 per 1,000 cubic feet under current law, the $4.43 under the bill is introduced, and then the $4.81 under the CS as the break-even prices that would be needed for in-state customers. And then you can see what those look like if you had different gas purchase prices or different capital cost assumptions. And then again, to reiterate, the committee substitute does have those caps on in-state gas prices to utilities, and that is incorporated into the modeling.
And the in-state price cap was $12.
Chair Giesel, so it's $12 prior to exports, and then it's $5 once exports begin. And that's per 1,000 cubic feet, and those are not inflation adjusted. And so where we see the impact of those caps is as we get into the later years, since the caps are not inflation adjusted, we do see those impacting the prices.
Gotcha. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it's funny, I never thought to ask this earlier on in these presentations. You've given us a bunch of these kinds of charts, but I think I understand what blue means, and I understand what green means, and I understand what red means. Does yellow mean that they are profitable, or does yellow mean that they are not at break even? What color actually means that they're not breaking even here?
Sure, Senator Dunbar, through the chair. So we didn't assign a specific price target to a specific color. We just green is a lower price, red is a higher price. We had Excel automatically do the color gradient.
Follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you're saying the color gradients don't have anything to do with whether or not they're breaking even. It's all just they're breaking even at all these points. So in theory, they're earning 10% at each of these price points.
Senator Dunbar, through the chair. So yes, these represent the price that would be required for the developer to earn that 10% rate of return. And I think in terms of qualifying what the colors mean, I think the next slide would probably be a little bit more appropriate for that discussion.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. I see no more questions on this one. We can go to slide 33.
Sure. And so slide 33 is the similar sensitivity matrix, but with the break-even LNG prices into the global market. Mm-hmm. Again, under our baseline assumptions, $9.07 under current law, $8.48 under the bill as introduced, and then $9.11 under the committee substitute. And these represent the prices that would be required for the project to earn that 10% rate of return to the developer. And I mentioned this in terms of the red and green, because right now, if you go out 6 to 8 years into the LNG futures market, delivered prices in the futures market are in the $8 to $9 range. And so that gives you kind of a ballpark of what sort of price might be needed to make the project attractive. The $8 to $9 prices do correlate to the green. Anything in the yellow category would be challenging, quite challenging. And then anything in the red category, I think, would certainly preclude the project from working.
So how did, Mr. Stickle, how did the 10% break even get established?
Sure, Chair Giesel. So that was an assumption that we developed in collaboration with AGDC. So we're assuming a 10% pre-tax rate of return. That is intended to be reflective of the range of rates of return that are typically granted to regulated pipelines. So typically for a pipeline project and investment of this nature, that's the kind of the minimum rate of return that a developer would be targeting.
Okay.
We do have the ability to run sensitivity analysis on that. I think in a previous presentation we showed 7.5% and a 12 or 15% rate of return.
I've heard that the 12 to 15 is actually more common. So any questions on this slide, 33? All right, seeing none.
All right, and then slide 34 is the conclusion slide. This should look familiar. So AKLNG project has the potential to generate significant revenue to the state and significant economic benefits and energy security benefits to the state and to the country. The bill as introduced was a material decrease to the cost of gas and would absolutely make the project more attractive to investors and the developer. The version before the committee would not be a significant change from current law in terms of cost of gas provided. It would be a slight tax decrease initially and then a slight tax increase over the life of the project. And then finally, with the caps on the in-state gas prices, that would almost certainly preclude an in-state only or this phase one only pipeline. The economics of that just wouldn't work. So that's all I had for this presentation.
Very good. Any questions on this presentation? All right, seeing none. So I had asked if you could give us an evaluation of what it would look like if we were to increase the gas production tax rates. So thank you for preparing this.
All right. Yeah, so this next presentation looks at that, and slide two kind of outlines the request. So we were asked to look at, so currently there is a gross tax on North Slope gas in the amount of 13% of gross value, and we were asked to look at that in 1% increments up to a 17% gross tax, and what would the fiscal impacts of that be. And so we based this analysis on this is based on current tax law other than the project tax rate, so we haven't integrated this necessarily with any particular version of the bill.
Gotcha. Okay.
Disclaimer as we go into any talk of severance tax. So it's a very complex severance tax, and there's a lot of moving pieces. And I'm an economist, not an auditor, so this is not an official tax determination or tax device advice. So slide four, how does the North Slope production tax work presently? So for gas, there's a 13% tax on the gross value at point of production. That was a tax rate that took effect in 2022. Previously, gas was part of the net profits tax calculation alongside oil with a 35% tax rate. The 13% gross tax was implemented as part of previous gas line legislation, which envisioned a possibility that the state would be taking ownership of both royalty and tax, taking ownership of about 25% of the gas and would take its royalty and tax in kind. And so that's where the 13% tax on gross tax combined with about a 12.5% gross royalty got you to about that 25% total gross tax. And so that's where the 13% came from, but that did take effect January of 2022. Now there is a tax ceiling in place. It is 17.7 cents per 1,000 cubic feet. That's a tax ceiling on gas used in-state. And the idea there is to limit the tax liability for tax or for gas supplied to Alaskans and utilities and allow for a potentially a higher tax rate for export gas. And the interplay of this gross tax and the tax ceiling becomes important as we go into the scenarios that we're going to run through here. In particular, if we assume a $1.50 per 1,000 cubic feet purchase price, the 17.7 cent tax ceiling is a lower tax rate than the 13% of gross value. And so at any of these 13 to 17% gross tax rates for in-state gas, the tax ceiling is going to apply, the 17.7 cents. The gas tax is calculated independently of the oil tax before applying credits, and I have a flow chart on the next slide that'll walk through that. All lease expenditures are applied in the oil tax calculation, so if a company is producing both oil and gas, they'll pay the 13% gross tax subject to the tax ceiling. For the gas portion of their production, they'll pay the 35% net tax minus credits for the oil tax portion of their tax calculation. And then any of the costs of operating and developing those fields are deducted as part of the net tax calculation on the oil side of things. And then this final bullet point is relevant as well for gas production tax, which is that the minimum tax floor, which is calculated based on North Slope oil value, is applied as a statewide tax floor as well as a North Slope oil tax floor.
So that tax floor is 4%.
Chair Giesel, correct. 4% of the gross value of North Slope oil becomes the tax floor for the statewide production tax calculation.
Senator Myers.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Stickle, that 17.7 cents gas ceiling, is that inflation adjusted?
Senator Myers, through the chair, no.
Okay, thank you.
All right, moving on.
All right, so moving on to slide five, this was a new chart that we inserted into our order of operations presentation this year to kind of try to distill down the complexity of the oil and gas production tax into a picture. And so on the top here, tax before credits is calculated individually based on different segments or ring fences of production. North Slope oil is a segment. All of your fields on the North Slope are combined into one tax calculation. North Slope gas is a separate segment. Middle Earth oil and Middle Earth gas are their own segments. Middle Earth refers to any production outside the North Slope and Cook Inlet. And then within the Cook Inlet, every single field is its own segment. So there's a separate oil tax and a separate gas tax for every lease or property in Cook Inlet. And those are all the segments. So if you have Cook Inlet production, you have a lot of different segments. Tax ceilings and tax floors apply within every one of these segments, actually. And that becomes your statewide tax before credits is the sum of the tax liability after accounting for tax ceilings and floors for each of those segments. Then tax credits get applied. The primary tax credits are the per barrel credits for the North Slope oil production, and the per barrel credit for legacy oil or oil not allowed, not subject to gross value reduction provisions. That's the sliding scale per taxable barrel credit. That credit is limited to the tax floor, and the tax floor, which is calculated on the North Slope oil value. And so there's an interplay between all of these things. And when we were talking about the impact of lease expenditures and AKLNG on production tax, it's really all of the nuance in this picture of how all of these pieces interplay. And when you add in gas tax, it doesn't always work out to exactly 13% of the value translating into revenue. But in any case, this North Slope gas tax segment is kind of the focus of this presentation, and it's that 13% gross tax subject to the tax ceiling, and we're varying that tax rate on this one specific segment.
Very good. So in Cook Inlet, if they're only producing in Cook Inlet, well, I'm not sure what my question is, so never mind.
It's a baffling slide.
It is. It's really excellent. You did a great job on it. It's definitely complex.
So can I ask a question?
Yes, Senator Dunbar.
The bottom right, when it says tax, statewide tax less credits can go to zero. Is that only for oil, or can you also drive the – it's a gross, not a net tax, but is there some way to also drive the gas tax to zero?
Yes, Senator Dunbar, through the chair. So there's a decision point here on which tax credits to use. The 024J is a reference to the non-gross value reduction or the sliding scale per taxable barrel credits. That is the credit that is limited by the minimum tax floor. So if a company chooses to avail themselves of those credits, then they must pay us at least the minimum tax floor, which is based on the 4% of the value of North Slope oil tax. If a company does not use those credits, then they can use other credits to take their tax liability all the way down to zero. Those other credits primarily would be the per taxable barrel credit for new oil, the $5 credit for gross value reduction eligible oil. And so, yes, those credits then could be used to offset oil tax or gas tax. And actually, the gas tax can be offset by the sliding scale credits down to the minimum tax floor. And so in our modeling, those both of those scenarios can come into play.
Senator Myers.
Yeah, two things. First off, this slide makes me not envy your job. Second off, the Cook Inlet by segment, I know we've sold some leases in Cook Inlet recently, and I think we've started production on a couple of them recently, but I haven't seen – I don't remember bills coming through talking about the taxes in Cook Inlet in the last couple, 3 years here. Are those by segment pieces set by DOR and regulation then?
Senator Myers, to the chair, no. So the segments are set by statute. So the Cook Inlet oil tax is subject to a 35% net profits tax with no tax credits. However, there is a permanent tax ceiling of $1 per taxable barrel for Cook Inlet oil tax. And that is on a by field basis for the segment. And then the Cook Inlet gas tax is the 13% of gross value with a permanent tax ceiling. The tax ceilings in Cook Inlet vary by lease or property. So some of them are at a zero tax ceiling. Some of them are over 30 cents per 1,000 cubic feet. The weighted average is a little under the 17.7 cents. And then any fields that have come into production since 2006 are at the 17.7 cents tax ceiling.
Okay, thank you.
All right.
Yeah. No, so further questions. Chair Giesel, just to some of the questions in the ceiling. So this kind of illustrates some of the complexity in the production tax system and how we've made multiple changes over the years. These tax ceilings for Cook Inlet actually refer back to the economic limit factor, or ELF tax, that was in place prior to 2006. And so with the PPT in 2006 and then ACES in 2007 and SB 21 in 2013, we've layered layers of complexity, and we've grandfathered different provisions in. And so that's where a lot of this complexity comes, is we've just kind of evolved and built onto the system over time.
Gotcha. Thank you. I think we're ready to move on.
Which is a great lead into slide 6, gas production tax complexity. So talked about some of this already. There's the interaction with the gas production tax and the oil production tax. And then, so the impact of gas production on a company that also produces oil can be positive to tax revenue. It can be negative to tax revenue. It can be neutral to tax revenue. And when I presented in the Finance Committee back in February, we laid out some very detailed scenarios of how each of those hypothetical situations could come to be.
And I did supply committee members with your PowerPoint from that presentation. I think it was February 13th or around in there. So they have received that.
Excellent. Okay, so slide 7 is our modeling assumptions for this particular analysis. So we looked at what the gas production tax would be from the AKLNG project, given the same AKLNG assumptions that we've been working through in the previous presentation.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Myers.
Thank you. Mr. Stickle, in the very bottom one there, the 18% being used in state. Is that also saying that the gas used as fuel gas at the treatment, or excuse me, at the LNG plant qualifies for the in-state use?
Senator Myers, through the chair, I believe that's the case. We need to check and confirm on that. And unfortunately, my lifeline is not available. I believe that's the case, but we'll confirm on that.
Okay, thank you.
And so what's going on here is in phase one for those initial 2029 and 2030, all of the gas, this relates to how much of the gas is subject to that 17.7 cent tax ceiling. So for those first 2 years, all of the gas production is subject to the tax ceiling. Once exports begin, 18% of the gas is subject to the tax ceiling, and that does increase up to the 23% later in the project, because we assume that in-state demand will increase throughout the life of the project. Essentially, you have a low-cost source of supply that will gradually fill in for declines in Cook Inlet production. And also, given the low cost of supply, we expect increases in demand from industry and other baseload consumers.
All right. Ready to move on.
So slide 8 put some numbers to these. So we ran 5 different sets of numbers here, showing our cumulative incremental production tax revenue. So this is both oil and gas production tax revenue over 10, 20, or 30 years of full exports. And we showed that with the gross gas tax rates of up 13 through 17%. So under the status quo with the 13% gross tax rate, about $10 billion of total production tax associated with the AKLNG development. That would be for both oil and gas. And then with the 17% gross tax rate, that increases to $12.3 billion.
Any questions? Yes, Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking at the, is the incremental growth in revenue smooth from across percentage points, or do you, is there a different marginal value? I'm trying to do the math quickly in my head. It looks similar.
Senator Dunbar, through the chair, it's fairly smooth, and I think that's illustrated in the coming slides where we graph out each of those percentages.
Thank you.
So you are assuming that oil production from Point Thompson, the condensates, will increase over time. By what, how much do you expect? I mean, do you have a percentage you expect each year?
Sure, Chair Giesel. So it's a significant increase in production. It works out to 270 million barrels over the life of the project. And basically, when Point Thompson begins producing gas into the project for export, we expect a large increase in oil production along with that. I don't have the exact numbers with me. It's many tens of thousands of barrels per day, and we expect that to be fairly stable for many years before starting to decline in the later years.
Gotcha. So in looking at, and I think I brought it with me, perhaps not, there was an EIS, a final EIS. Here it is. It was done. Well, I'll get those later. I think this was 2022. But they did speculate a potential on the North Slope. Now, this was not, this is not all Point Thompson. This is actually Prudhoe. But a potential loss of 452 million barrels if the gas, if the oil, yeah, gas production was initiated in 2029. Is that, now it, that's in a scenario where the reservoir pressure would steadily decrease as the gas was extracted. I don't know how much AOGCC took that into account when they approved the gas offtake. Do you have any information about that?
Chair Giesel, I don't have detailed insights.
Okay.
I've seen the same document you reference, as well as the prior document from BP that had some slightly lower decline numbers. The assumption that we are baking into the modeling for Prudhoe Bay is that there will be no net oil impacts.
Yes.
We certainly have the ability to run scenarios. So we could look at, you know, a scenario where there was a lower oil production, anywhere up to that 450 million barrel oil loss. That's a scenario that we could run if desired.
Okay, thank you. We will be talking with AOGCC later, I think tomorrow, actually. So thank you. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm just trying to interpret these numbers a little bit. I did some quick math here. So it looks like through 2042, each percentage point gets you about $173 to $174 million. I didn't see it broken out elsewhere, but oh, there it is. I guess slide 12. All right, I'll wait till we get to slide 12 then. That's my question. Thank you.
Sure.
All right, I see no more questions on slide 8.
All right, so slide 9 is our first of several charts. So what we're showing here is the annual, taking those totals over many years and breaking them down into the annual values. What is the annual additional production tax revenue associated with the AKLNG project-related development? And so we can see... and we've plotted it out here with the current gross tax rate of the 13% for gas ranging up to the 17% for gas. And then the next slide, slide 10, put slides 10 and 11 put some bullet points to further dig into this same chart.
That's great.
So slide 10 shows some of the different time periods here. So from 2033 through 2051, in general for production tax revenue, increases to from inflation. So we're assuming higher overall value as prices increase. That roughly balance declining production at Point Thompson. So we do have that incremental production comes in strong and then declines over time, as with any typical oil field decline rate. And then that decline rate increases in the later years of the modeling. And also a point in the last 7 years or so of the modeling here is we are not counting on production tax revenue and royalty from so-called yet-to-find gas. So once we get out beyond the 20-year time horizon, there is a need for some additional gas above and beyond what we're forecasting from Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson. We haven't baked in the upstream revenues from that gas, so that represents a potential upside from the project.
I see no questions.
Slide 11 continues with the bullet points. So as we've talked about previously, for the first few years of production, there is a negative incremental production tax that relates to a deduction of development costs from the oil tax calculation, and also some of that interaction with the per taxable barrel credits that we talked about earlier in this slide deck. We are assuming some significant additional development costs at Point Thompson. That bullet point should say 2038 instead of 2034. That's a modeling assumption. So we're assuming that the Point Thompson incremental development will happen in two stages, that there will be a stage of development in the near future with some additional infrastructure and wells being drilled, and then another stage about a decade further on with some additional drilling as well. And so you see with that bullet point five, just the impact of that that additional investment in that 1 year. And that's nothing magic about 2038. That's just the assumption of where we put that spend.
Gotcha. Very good. Any questions? All right.
So slide 12 looks at the cumulative impact compared to current law. And so looking at the 10, 20, and 30-year numbers that we showed before, how much additional revenue would the state raise from going from the 13% tax rate up to the 14%, up to the 17%? And so, you can see that over 10 years, over the first 10 years, there would be about $174 million of additional state revenue by increasing that rate by 1%, and then about $590 million if we increased over the 30-year time horizon.
Very good. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this is where I'll ask my question. Why is it? Does it increase just because of inflation, or is there something else driving it up? And at first, I thought maybe it was because Point Thompson was backed out in 2038, but that doesn't make sense because Point Thompson would apply regardless of which percentage we're at. So what? Why are we getting more profits? Or I'm sorry, more revenues in the out years when we're at max capacity in 2033?
Sure. So, Senator Dunbar, through the chair. So, the next slide will actually show a chart of this and put some finer points on that. These numbers on slide 12, these are cumulative over the. So the first column represents revenues through 2042, and then the last column also includes you know, includes the 32, mm-hmm. 33 years of revenue. To the question, there is an increasing value of the gas. If we assume a fairly constant throughput of gas into the project, we are assuming that gas prices will increase with inflation at 2.5%. And so we are assuming that the gross tax will effectively increase by 2.5% per year in nominal terms.
Follow-up, Madam Chair.
Yes, follow-up, Senator Dunbar.
So I'm trying to think in terms of annual revenue impacts based on each percentage point. And it looks like it's – I mean, the first one's easiest to do, right? That's 17.4, it looks like, million per year. Am I doing that right? And then
– Senator Dunbar, through the chair. So for impacts per year, I would refer you to slide 13. But that 174 represents about a decade of full export production. So that would be about 17.4 million per year, roughly.
And then logically, Madam Chair,
yes.
If I might follow up. And then
yes, follow up.
You multiply that by two and you know, you're at basically 35 million a year. And that's pretty close to 347 million. And then increases a little bit with inflation. It looks like it goes up to almost $20 million a year through 2052. I mean, if you divide, you know, basically 400 by 20. But that's generally what we're looking at, sort of maybe $17 to $20 million per year, somewhere in that range per percentage point. Is that correct?
Senator Dunbar, through the chair, yes, that's correct.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Now, this particular policy change would not affect the likelihood of the project going forward. Would that be a correct statement?
Chair Giesel, not necessarily. So an increase to the tax rate for the upstream could potentially impact the price that the upstream owner would be willing to sell their gas for. So if they know that they're going to face a higher tax burden, they may want to get a little bit higher amount of revenue to offset that, which could have some impact on project economics.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So thanks for 2 points. One, I was unaware of the 17.7 cent ceiling, which seems like an incredibly specific number, and I'd love to know how that was arrived at. But it sounds like we're already at that ceiling. And so if this were to increase, the price at least wouldn't be passed on to in-state consumers. I guess that's my first question. And then my second is, and I know you're probably not the right person to ask this, but maybe someone else online is, if the pipe is built and it's up there on the North Slope, how does the duty to produce under the leases play with this? So, you know, you said that maybe they could pass those costs on, but if we can demonstrate that they're making a reasonable profit, are they actually able to pass those costs on if they have a duty to produce the gas?
Senator Dunbar, through the chair, so I would absolutely defer the duty to produce question. I can answer the question about the 17.7 cents, however. So the 17.7 cents represents the weighted average gas production tax rate in Cook Inlet that was in place under the ELF tax system in 2006. And so what we did when we passed the net profits tax, the petroleum profits tax in 2006, is we set a tax ceiling for production in Cook Inlet. And for each field, that tax ceiling was based on the average tax rate for the field for the previous 12 months. Hmm. For oil, the average tax rate in Cook Inlet was zero for all fields. So there was a zero tax ceiling in place for Cook Inlet. For gas, the average tax rate varied by field. But on average, it was at 17.7 cents. And so what we've done is for any Cook Inlet field that was in production prior to 2006, we've frozen their pre-2006 tax rate as a tax ceiling. For any new fields, it's the 17.7 cents tax ceiling. And we have also, for in-state gas from areas outside of Cook Inlet, including the North Slope, we've referenced back to that Cook Inlet tax ceiling so that all in-state gas has that same tax ceiling.
Follow-up, Madam Chair?
Yes, follow-up.
And to a certain degree, I'm just doing my own check on learning here. Mm-hmm. So you said 17.7 cents. Now, this is percent, and you're assuming they're selling at $1.50. So, you know, whatever this is, 14% of $1.50 is already over 17.7 cents. Is that why we're already hitting the ceiling at all of these points?
Yes. Senator Dunbar, through the chair, that's correct.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Further questions? All right. Seeing none.
All right. So the final content slide is slide 13. And so this shows the impact compared to current law of holding all else equal of going from the 13% gross tax up to the 14, 15, 16, or 17 cent gross tax. And as you can see, until 2032, there is no impact from any of these tax changes. And that's exactly because of that in-state tax ceiling, which governs at 13%. And so whatever increases to the gross tax rate are implemented would not impact in-state gas, assuming the $1.50 per MCF purchase price. And then once come 2033, once we have full exports, we would assume some impacts from this policy change. And then the value of that additional revenue would increase over time with inflation, and then dropping off in the later years of our modeling, again, based on what I described earlier, where we're not counting in revenue from the yet-to-find production yet.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Stickle, the governor has proposed an alternate volumetric tax. We already have this tool in our toolbox. If our goal was to raise a similar amount of money to an alternate volumetric tax, what are the pros and cons, or positives and negatives, of using one of those tools versus the other?
Sure. So, Senator Dunbar, through the chair, I think just off the top of my head, one of the key differences is that the alternative volumetric tax applies to the midstream, and the project and the ability to make the project financeable and economic, whereas the gross tax rate applies to the upstream. So you're dealing with a different set of customers, or a different set of taxpayers, and a different set of economic decision making.
Yes, follow Dunbar, Senator Dunbar.
You know, there are no firm contracts that I know of, at least on the right. North Slope for this gas, but if the producers were to write into the contract that they could pass on these increases to the midstream purchaser in the purchase price, would it sort of be a wash? Would you be agnostic from a public policy perspective as Department of Revenue whether you use this tool or the AVT?
Senator Dunbar, through the chair, I feel like that answer probably has some nuance, and I'd probably want to consult and report back on that one.
Understood. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
So, Mr. Stickle, I'm looking here that this particular policy change would not have an impact until 2032 when they were at full export production. I mean, So I guess I'm having trouble seeing how this might affect the project going forward, because it wouldn't affect it until they got to full export, which is where most of the return is for the midstream and the producers.
Yeah, sure, Chair Giesel. So it would be at the margins, it would be an increase in in tax liability for the upstream producers. And so that would, at the margins, impact their economics, and presumably it would impact their negotiations with the developer as to what gas price they're willing to accept.
But this wouldn't, but I'm looking at the graph. It shows that it has zero impact.
Yeah, Chair Giesel, it's a zero impact through 2032. But then, as we showed on the previous slides, there is a, you know, going back to slide 12, we'll look at the cumulative impact. Mm-hmm. And so these cumulative impacts are essentially the cumulative tax increase on the producers. And so they'd be, for each person, you know, we talk about the $17 to $20 million per year average over the life of project of increased revenue to the state. That's also a $17 to $20 million per year tax increase to the producers.
So on slide 13, that yellow line that's at the zero up to 2032 is actually higher than zero.
Chair Giesel, so these are, slide 13 shows annual revenues. And so there would be, under our modeling assumptions, there would be zero change to the to each individual year of tax liability through 2032. And then beginning in 2033, there would be increased tax liabilities.
I see. Okay, gotcha. All right. Any other questions? Seeing none. Thank you. Welcome, Senator Klayman. All right. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Stickle. Any other questions for Mr. Stickle today? All right. Thank you for joining us. All right. So we have... there was an amendment deadline last week, and I do have some amendments that were turned in, and so we'll go through those right now.
Brief at ease, Madam Chair.
Brief at ease. We're back on the record. Senator Rauscher, we just want to confirm that you can hear us and are able to respond.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Can you guys hear me?
Yes. Can you hear us?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, great, great.
I can hear you.
All right. So we've concluded the Department of Revenue's presentation. And we're going to take up amendments that were offered when the amendment deadline occurred last week. So we wanted to make sure that you could hear us, since many of these amendments are yours. In fact, I think all but one.
Yes, I understand. I'll do the best I can from afar while traveling.
All right. Very good. Thank you. So the First Amendment is offered by Senator Myers. It is, and as you look at your amendments there, it is Amendment Number G3. Senator Myers?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'll move Amendment G3.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So what G3 does is it makes spur lines exempt from the standard property taxes. As of right now in the bill, we are exempting the main line from the regular oil and gas property tax, but then adding in the AVT instead. So this would extend that to the potential spur lines, particularly the Fairbanks spur. So I'm doing it for the Fairbanks spur, but it would apply as written to all spurs as defined in the bill. At the current estimate for spur line construction for Fairbanks and at current customer levels for Fairbanks, The standard 20 mil property tax rate would mean approximately an extra $1,000 per customer per year that would have to get passed on to pay that tax. The gas coming down from the slope would already have the 30 cents added from the AVT, 15 cents from the gas treatment plant and 15 cents from the pipeline. So the gas is already being taxed, so that would be over and above that. A couple of things to note. The way that spur lines are defined in the bill, which is on page 31, lines 15 and 16, it says that it's a pipeline that'll connect to a local community or utility network. So if you built a spur to Fairbanks and go into IGU's network, that would qualify. But it would not qualify if you built a spur, for example, over to Donlin Mine, which is one thing that has been discussed, because that's not going to a community or to a utility. That's going to a specific industrial customer. Another reason that matters is because there has been talk recently that the Fairbanks spur could potentially just end up being a spur that is built that just goes to a data center or a power plant on Eielson. And not into IGU's network, and in that case, it would not qualify. So we've talked so much here about how we want to keep gas prices lower for in-state use, and particularly for residential customers. This is what this amendment is attempting to do.
Very good. So let me orient the committee, first of all. This amendment was drafted to version G. Mm-hmm. We have version H before us right now. And so the correlating locations in version H are section 38, that's on page 27. And the definition is, I just saw it and I marked the page and now I can't find it. Oh, it's on page 31 of version H, section 43, and it's in F. 43F. Mm-hmm. The alternative tax does not apply to the spur line. So, there she is. Ms. Kawasaki? And this section, as you pointed out, Senator Myers, the alternative tax under the section does not apply to a spur line. Property tax associated with a spur line remains subject to taxation. Ms. Kawasaki, comment on this amendment.
Good afternoon, members of the committee, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Sonia Kawasaki. Senate Majority Legal Counsel. I think that Senator Myers accurately stated the mechanics of this amendment for the purposes of the bill as written, which was this was version G. And I appreciate the extra explanation on the possibility of not applying to an industrial area. And I guess it would be up to the members if this is a policy decision that they want to include. One thing I will note is that section 31 of the bill was part of the governor's bill. It was an attempt to relate the existing petroleum property tax to sort of model that the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation operates under now, and especially in light of with its partner Glenfarne. And if you read the amendment, you can see that AGDC, the exemption for taxes under the petroleum property tax had been prior to introduction as a change for the alternative volumetric tax. It was the exemption for petroleum property taxes was meant to apply to AGDC or joint ventures, partnerships, or other entities that include AGDC. And those were exempt currently under current law. But because of the new model that I think ADDC has approached the gas line project, that the attempt was to create a mechanism that anyone who is involved in this gas line project would be exempt from taxation. And Senator Meyer's amendment would simply add the spur line to the exemption as well.
Madam Chair, if I may add to that slightly.
Senator Myers.
Yeah. So as of right now, the talk of the spur line getting built is Glenn Farn would, as of the moment anyway, I know it's rapidly changing, Glenn Farn is not necessarily going to be involved in building the spur line, nor would AGDC. The current talk is having NSTAR and Doyon partner together to build a spur to Fairbanks.
Thank you, Senator Meyer. Other questions for Senator Meyer? Senator Wilkowski.
I'm trying to find the definition for spur line. And
in the current bill, which is version H, it's on page 31. No, wait, that isn't the definition, is it?
Yeah, yes, it is.
On page
17, 18, yeah.
Yes, there it is. Branches from the main gas pipeline project to deliver natural gas to a local community or utility distribution system or similar infrastructure not serving as a primary export or mainline transmission facility. So, Senator Wilkowski.
I'm just curious if this could somehow be interpreted to mean that gas lines that are running across the North Slope to deliver gas to various places. And maybe that's a question for revenue.
Mr. Stickle?
Sure. Dan Stickle for the record. Could you repeat the question, please?
Yeah. Just trying to figure out the definition of spur line here. And it's defined on page 31 of version H, lines 16 through 20. I don't know if you have that in front of you.
Looks like I do.
Could you describe whether or not that potentially means any of the lines running across the North Slope?
Senator Wilkowski through the chair. So I understand the intent is not to include transmission lines. I wouldn't be qualified to give a legal interpretation off the cuff. I could speak to what I understand the intent to be, which would not to be including the transmission lines on the North Slope.
Madam Chair, if I may to that.
And I think it's the F1 that would specifically describe that it's a branch from the main line to deliver the gas into a local community or system.
Very good follow-up.
Are there any utilities on the North Slope within the office other than Barrow?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, yes, there are utilities on the slope.
So that would be excluded from this definition? Or that would rather be included and not become tax exempt under this?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, it's a good question. I'm really not qualified to opine off the cuff.
And
follow up.
I'm just looking at 31250054, and because that's referenced in number two, and or similar infrastructure not serving as the primary export and mainline. I don't know what that means. I don't know how broad that is.
If I may, Madam Chair.
Senator Myers.
Yeah, thank you. So I did check that. That statute reference there on line 19, that goes back to AGDC's original enabling statutes that it had two options. Effectively, it said either AGDC is going to work on an in-state only line, previous version was referred to it as ASAP line. That's the four. And then the second one was it's going to work on an export project. That was five under that 3125005. In both cases, we're talking about a line coming off of the slope. The existing utility in the Prudhoe Bay area that serves the oil field company, you know, all the airport there and all the oil field service companies and the like. That's not branching off of either the main natural gas pipeline I described in one or branching off of the in-state only pipeline, which was described in line 19 there. So the way I read it, in neither case would the North Slope utility qualify.
Other questions, Senator Dunbar?
Yeah, follow up, Madam Chair. Thank you. So I'm looking at the language of the amendment itself, though, on page 1, line 13, and line 12 and 13. I'm relating it back to the bill. And I know that it sort of lives in a part of the law that is intended to be related to the project. But the way it reads here is for the construction, operations, or maintenance of a natural gas pipeline project or spur line. And so just by adding or spur line there, because it's not attached to anything else, it doesn't say it's a spur line related to the project. I do wonder if we are inadvertently perhaps exempting existing spur lines in the North Slope or elsewhere. I'm willing to be talked out of that, but just reading sort of the plain language of the amendment seems to do that.
Well, when it, Madam Chair,
Senator Myers.
Thank you. So when we talked to legal to get this drafted, we specifically referenced with them spur line as was defined there on, well, what is now page 31, lines 15 and 16, and as the definition for spur line. So that's the direction that we went. I would have to go back and double check some of the other references for spur line. But when we went to legal, we said specifically this is what we want.
I'll just say, Madam
Senator
Chair.
Senator Dunbar, follow up.
If we adopt this amendment, Madam Chair, we're certainly building a record right now, I think, in our discussion that we do not intend this, and the Maker Amendment doesn't intend this to exempt all of the existing North Slope spur lines. I think the word project on line 17 and 31 probably does the most work here. It's not just the branching off a main natural gas pipeline. It's a main natural gas pipeline project, which I think we all take to mean this project. But thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Wilikowski.
I'm wondering if for Mr. Stickle or whoever, maybe, I guess we don't have anybody.
We don't have anyone online. He's solo today.
Looking at page 31, lines 14 through 20, it says we're creating the alternative volumetric tax. It says the alternative tax under this section does not apply to a spur line. Then it goes on, property associated with a spur line remains subject to taxation. And so I guess I'm curious if there are current property associated with a spur line that remains subject to taxation that might be excluded by this amendment, if you know.
Sure. Senator Wilikowski through the chair. So I haven't looked in detail at this amendment. The oil and gas property tax does apply to oil and gas pipelines. Aside from distribution, local distribution lines, but it doesn't broadly apply to oil and gas pipelines, including on the slope. And the intent here is to exempt just the in the base bill is to exempt just the AKLNG project and the main line, and to not exempt a spur line.
Yeah. Madam Chair.
Senator Myers.
Yeah, if we go to the second page of the amendment, very first line, spur line has the meaning given in 4359.010E. I understand that because of some change between G and H, that is now 4359.010F, which is the definition that we were just speaking about. And again, because it does not because the utility on the slope does not branch off of the main pipeline that is being built that would start at the gas treatment plant and head south. Therefore, it would not qualify.
So in this amendment, Senator Myers, you're intending this to be referring to the spur serving Fairbanks. But that may not be the only spur line that comes off the main line. Mm-hmm. Certainly there's the Mat-Su. One could come off there. One could come off at the Yukon River. We've talked about that in the past. Mm-hmm. So all of those would be exempt from the petroleum property tax also, since this is broadly saying spur line.
Yes. So it is broadly saying spur line. I've been in a couple of discussions that have mentioned potentially a branch off to the Cantwell area, to the Healy area. But in those cases, again, we're talking about in the definition already used in the bill, a spur line going into either utility or community distribution network. I don't believe Cantwell or Healy have those yet, but they would have to get built. But you'd be talking about, again, a community network. And again, the only result of that would be passing on this tax as a cost to Alaskans. I wrote this primarily regarding the Fairbanks spur, but I recognized in language, yes, that could apply to other spurs. But when we're talking about going to people's homes, we're not talking about, as I said, we're not talking about going to Donlin, for example. That would be a spur line in the technical sense, but not a spur line in the legal sense of what we're doing here. Then that could still get passed on to that industrial customer standard, you know, under the usual 20 mil property tax. That would still apply. If there was a spur line that was dedicated to, say, Fort Knox mine up in Fairbanks, that would also, the 20 mil tax would still apply, as well as, you know, and in addition to, you know, the Fairbanks borough property tax as well, you know, all the usuals. But if we're talking about something that goes into a utility network that's going to people's homes, or into a community network going into people's homes, that should be tax exempt, because otherwise the only thing that we're doing is raising the price of gas for Alaskans. And we're already taxing that gas as it is, because just in coming down the pipe, it's already got 30 cents attached to it per MCF.
Thank you for that. Senator Wilikowski.
I'm wondering if revenue knows, or somebody knows, do the lines for like NSTAR, does NSTAR pay property taxes on their gas lines that deliver gas to throughout South Central?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, Dan Stickle, for the record, at the state level, no. I'm not positive on the municipal level.
Senator Wilikowski.
I'm not necessarily opposed to this amendment. I just feel like I don't have enough understanding at this moment to be able to vote on it. And I would like the opportunity to consider it some more, if you're open for that. If I had to vote on it, I'd vote no right now, but I could be persuaded if we dug in a little bit more.
Senator Myers, would you object to us setting this amendment aside for further consideration the next time we do amendments?
Madam Chair, I don't mind that. Not knowing the timeline for sure, the timeline of when we're trying to kick this bill out of committee, that's the only concern that I have. But otherwise, I'm open to that.
All right. Thank you. With that, then, with the committee's consent and Senator Myers' consent, let's set this aside. So that we can dig into it a bit more. The fundamental rationale is sound. We just want to make sure that we're not doing something we don't mean to do. So this amendment, while it's drafted to version G, it should be to section 38 on page 27 of H. I'm just making note of this for myself in case I forget where it was. And the definition is on page 31, lines 14 through 20 is the definition of the spur line. All right, so we'll set this aside. Just making note here. All right, so that takes us to the next amendment, and I'm just going by the numbers of the amendments. Let me make sure I've got them. I lost my papers, so make sure they're not shuffled. There we go. So the next amendment is Amendment H4, and this is offered by Senator Rauscher. Senator Rauscher?
Madam Chair, I move Amendment number H4.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion. Senator Rauscher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, this one, basically, it deletes the S-Corp language. It makes for canvassing changes throughout. It basically, the reason here is I'm trying to find a path forward with probably the whoever's going to end up with the bill to sign. But anyway, removes a new tax that undermines the bill's purpose. It maintains Alaska's competitiveness, and it prevents unintended consequences. Keeps focus on the project, reduces risk of complex compliance issues and restructuring. I think there was some language and some discussion and some debate on what this may or may not pose in this particular bill, and that's the purpose. After listening to all of the many meetings that we've had in the many interviews, that's the reason for the that's the reason for the amendment.
Thank you, Senator Dunbar.
I guess I should say I oppose the amendment. Has there been an objection to the amendment?
I objected for purposes of discussion. Yes.
Very good. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just say to everyone, I there's an op-ed in the current edition of the Anchorage Daily News that I wrote about the S-Corp that I hope folks read. This would be Glenn Farn has not expressed that they are opposed to having this provision in there. This would be removing it would be a tremendous wealth transfer from the people of Alaska to Glenn Farn, which, you know, there's some, if that's what you want to do, that's fine. But we're talking hundreds, up to $460 million in the out year per year. So I think this is now an integral part of this bill. It does not burden the project or the ability of the project to get built. And so I would urge folks to vote no on this amendment. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Is there further discussion? Senator Myers.
Yeah. So I talked to a couple of folks recently about how some of the federal tax laws have intersected with what we've been doing here. It was brought to my attention that so far Glen Farne, Alaska has not yet registered with the IRS as to whether or not they're a C Corp or an S Corp. Well, and they haven't needed to yet because since they haven't made any money, they haven't had to file a tax return. We're not sure yet if Glen Farne is going to be registering as either a C or an S. But as I brought up, I believe, at our meeting yesterday, I believe that there is a good chance that they're going to need to register as a C Corp anyway in order to access the capital markets that they're going to need to build the line. On the chance that they don't need to be a C Corp, we've already heard from Gaffney Klein that even with the bill as was originally introduced by the governor 2 months ago, that we would still be at a competitive disadvantage to our Canadian neighbors because of when it comes to the total taxes on the project. We could eliminate the property tax entirely, not even do the AVT, and we would still be a little bit behind if corporate taxes do end up getting paid at the 9.4%, whether it's a C Corp or an S Corp. So on the off chance that they do decide to register as an S Corp, and again, I don't know which one they're going to register as. If that helps us with the project economics and actually gives us a better shot of this going forward, I think it's worth it. Otherwise, if we want to talk about the wealth transfer, then the end result is there will be no wealth transfer if the project is not built. There will be no potential lowering of gas costs if this is not built, if we don't get the full export portion. Otherwise, we already know where the gas costs are going. The gas costs in Cook Inlet is already $16 and going up. We've already heard that the import costs are already in the same range, and again, most likely going up. So if we want this project to have the best shot going forward, this helps.
Thank you. Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My recollection is Glen Farne testified they did not oppose this provision, if not outright supported it. And I don't want to say that they supported it, but I know they said they didn't oppose it. And so they're not claiming to this legislature that they need this to make the project happen. On the upstream side, I would note that based on the calculations we have from Department of Revenue, the producers stand to have an internal rate of return of 83% on their gas. And I don't think it's unreasonable that we capture some of the value of that. That's an extraordinary rate of return. And I would just like to point out that, you know, we like to talk about dividends and paying people dividends, and some people are supportive and some people are less supportive. Whether you want the money to go to education or dividends or wherever, this is how you lose your dividends with amendments like this. I want the people of Alaska who are listening at home, amendments like this cause you to lose your dividends, because what this is doing is transferring $400 million from the people of Alaska in the outer years to corporations, huge, huge, huge corporations that will make billions of dollars in profits. $400 million per year. Actually, it's a little bit more than that in the outer years. That comes out to every man, woman, and child in the state of Alaska losing $600, whether that's for a dividend, whether that's for education funding, whether that's for infrastructure funding. Every man, woman, and child of Alaska giving up $600 per person if this amendment passes right now. This is how you lose your PFDs. It's amendments like this. And that's why I'm voting no. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Wilkowski. I wish I had the transcript from yesterday's hearing in the other body, in their finance committee, because this question was asked by Representative Hannon. It was asked of Glenn Farn. And if I'm not mistaken, their answer was that they were an LLC, which is a pass-through entity. Regardless of whether they are a pass-through entity or not currently, if, in fact, they become a C corporation, as you mentioned, Senator Myers, would be required of them or whatever, or they choose to do that, this tax will be the same on them. This is the same corporate tax that C corps pay right now. So either way, the state of Alaska should be receiving this portion of income from companies that are making large profits in our state through oil and gas. So I would oppose this amendment as well. Further comments? Seeing none, Senator Rauscher, did you wish to have closing comments on this amendment?
Well, yeah, I appreciate it. I'm not sure that it hurts anyone's PSD if there's no pipeline. That really hurts everybody's PSD. So that's just my understanding. I'm not sure about the numbers and everything that we're giving, because we keep asking for numbers, but yet I don't know how those can come about without the numbers we haven't gotten that I heard just a bit ago. But anyway, I appreciate it very much, and that's my closing argument.
All right, thank you. I'm going to maintain my objection. Mariquin?
Senator Dunbar?
No.
Senator Klayman?
No.
Senator Wilkowski?
No.
Senator Kawasaki is not present.
No.
Senator Myers?
Yes.
Senator Rauscher?
Senator yes. Rauscher. Okay.
Senator Giesel?
No.
Did you not hear me?
Yes, we did. Pardon me, it's Juliana, is our secretary. You heard Senator Rauscher, Juliana?
Correct.
Very good. And I was a no.
Okay. The roll is 2 yeas, 4 nays.
And then a vote of 2 yeas and 4 nays, amendment number H4 fails to be adopted. So we are at the conclusion of our meeting today. We have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 more amendments to go. We will set these aside for our next hearing. And at this time, we will conclude our meeting, setting this aside for our next meeting, which is tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. At that time, let me take a look at what we have scheduled for tomorrow morning. Tomorrow morning is Wednesday, May 13th, and in the morning we will be hearing from Gaffney Klein. If there is time, we will also open for some public testimony tomorrow morning. So at this time, we will adjourn. Let the record reflect. The time is 4:59 p.m.